It's looking good. The red light's on. If you notice the red light is out, say something so we don't do that again. I have one piece of white chalk. Oh no, hang on, there's more. Never mind. Okay, so today I made the official title my fun title, Much Ado About N Equal 2. Yeah, this should be part two. And so my sort of slightly ambitious goal today is to explain somebody else's work. It's always tricky to explain somebody else's work because you don't understand it, unlike explaining your own, where you presumably do. So back in April, Gaiotto wrote a paper called N Equal 2 Dualities, which kind of kicked off the current flurry of activity about this stuff. And I'm going to try to explain what's in this paper today. And, well, I said in the abstract that if I had time, I would do some other stuff, but I don't think I'm even going to have time to explain all of this. So we'll see how it goes. So I mentioned what the basic idea and setup was last time, but let me just review it. So I'm looking at N equal to field theories, actually conformal field theories, generally speaking, in four dimensions, although we will also consider mass deformations of these theories, which break the conformal symmetry. So the tool that we have for understanding what these, how these theories behave is the theory of Zeiberg-Witten curves. And we'll actually try to say things about the Zeiberg-Witten curves for the families of theories that we're looking at here. So this has been the traditional tool. Gaiotto's new approach actually associates theories to a different curve. So keep with my philosophy. Zeiberg-Witten Riemann surfaces. So some kind of punctured Riemann surface with some other data, perhaps, that also helps to specify these particular N equal to conformal field theories. So I described last time how you realize these theories by wrapping an M5 brain around a punctured Riemann surface and maybe thinking about what the effective field theory description of that is, the four-dimensional theory on the brain. I'm going to focus today a little bit more on the original manipulations that Gaiotto made, how they're interpreted in terms of the Zeiberg-Witten curves. Sorry, I will say curve for Zeiberg-Witten. And since I'm not talking about that curve on surface thing today, maybe I'll just say curve for the most part. So how does it go? So the starting point is the SU2 theory with four flavors. So I want four copies of the fundamental representation. And the flavor symmetry for this theory, well, if we had just had the complex a complex representation of the group, then the flavor symmetry would have been SU4. But it's actually enhanced because of the pseudo-real nature of the representation to an SO8 symmetry. So there's actually an SO8 flavor symmetry. And we're only going to consider what happens under an SO4 cross SO4 subgroup of this SO8 symmetry. So that turns out to be, in Gaiotto's point of view, the right set of flavor symmetries to keep track of when you're trying to think about various weakly coupled limit points in the parameter space for these theories.
So these hypers are all massless in this
These are massless hypers. Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah. So as I mentioned, there'll be mass deformations in a little bit, but right now everything's massless. And SO4, of course, decomposes as SU2 cross SU2. Well, the purist in me wants to point out that's only a local decomposition, not a global decomposition. Maybe I want some plus or minus one someplace. But anyway, that's true at the level of algebras in any case. And so this is represented by Gaiotto by a diagram that looks as follows. I indicate the gauge group inside of a round circle. I indicate factors of the flavor group inside of square boxes. And I'm going to label the various SU2s as A, B, C, and D. And think of the whole picture as representing a diagram like that. So the claim is, and we'll see various justifications for this, it'll be easier to see the justification after I write down Seiberg-Witten curves, but I want to do the diagram manipulation for a little while before I do that. The claim is that different weakly coupled limits in this setup correspond to different groupings of ABC, of the ABCD, the labels for the flavor symmetry groups, into pairs. So instead of grouping them like that, I could group them like this. I could put this SU2A and this SU2C together and think of that as describing the SO4 that acts on two of the hypermultiplets, and then the other two hypermultiplets would be acted on, in this case, by the B and the D groups. So I think that interpretation had been around. I don't think that's a new observation. I can enhance this to a case where instead of just a single gauge group, so now what I want to do is take a sort of row of n SU2s. So I'm going to make a linear quiver.
Do you always have to preserve that sticky
quarter,
or can you
pair? No. Sorry, then there's another one, right? This is STU channel, right? So I can also do this, right? Or the other one. A linear quiver with n SU2s. So what is that going to mean? It's going to mean bifundamentals for adjacent ones, and then two hypers at each end. So it's a generalization of what I had over here. And so the two hypers at each end, I'm going to interpret the same way. It's having an SO4 symmetry, which is being split into two symmetry algebras, like that. Here I've got an SU2, which is being split. And then here, this bifundamental has a flavor symmetry of SU2. So this is the flavor symmetry of the bifundamental. So now I've got five. I'll label them A, B, well, let's be consistent with the previous one. A, B, C, D, and this new one, E. And the idea is if SU, and maybe these will be numbers one and two, if SU2 number two has its coupling, decouples, so if you take the coupling to zero, but you let this coupling vary, then you should be able to do the same kind of S-duality transformation. This was basically an S-duality transformation in this field theory. I remind you, as I mentioned last time, that the modular parameter for this theory is a tau, which is in the upper half plane. And this is really a kind of S-duality, a standard S-duality transformation for these theories. Here, if the SU2 sub 2 were to decouple, so that would look like an additional boxed SU2 flavor, and then I would expect to be able to apply my S-duality type transformations and get two possible results. And of course, if I then restore the coupling, at least at weak coupling, to this SU2, 2, I'll end up with some other spectrum than what I had. So in particular, if I take the A, so I could sort of end up with, the SU2 A here. I could end up with, well, what really amounts to SU2 2. And once it's sort of once its coupling is re-energized, I still have the C and the D attached to it. And then down here, I would have my B and my E. So this would be B, and this would be E. Or I could do the other one, where I pair A with E and B with 2, and then after re-energizing, I end up with a different picture. So these look like possible coupling limits. And the observation is that these S-duality permutations of the two gauge groups, SU2-1 and SU2-2, do not commute. And you end up with, instead of just this simple subgroup of S4, you end up with some interesting subgroup of S5, symmetric group on five letters, the five different possible factors of the flavor group in this picture. So there's a more complicated duality story, which happens when you start to look at these linear quivers. So that was the case n equal to, little n equal to, two gauge groups. And where it starts to get really interesting is little n equal 3. So for little n equal 3, let me just draw it. I've got three gauge groups I've got bifundamental matter for each one, and I'm identifying an SU2 flavor symmetry for each of these bifundamental representations, and then for the two hypermultiplets at the end I'm identifying a pair of SU2 gauge symmetries. Excuse me, flavor symmetries. And now I need lots of letters, A, B, C, D, E, F. So this time I've got six flavor groups in the picture.
Dave, can I ask some questions?
Yes, please do.
In that last circle in that drawing, is that SU2?
SU2. These are all S. Everything is an SU2. Thank you.
And then, just in the previous case, to make sure I understand.
Yes.
That correctly, since that's an SU2 times SU2 gauge theory.
That's right.
SU2 has two flavors not coupled to the other SU2, and one bifundamental.
That's right.
Each SU2 has four flavors.
Each SU2 has four flavors.
And the surprise is that the SU2 that acts on the bifundamental somehow gets permuted with the global SU2s when you go through various decoupling singularities.
Yeah, so I think this hadn't been claimed before, that if you run the coupling of SU2, of this second SU2 all the way to zero, turning it into a flavor group, that you would then be able to act by the S-duality on this one, and you'd be still be able to to lift that action to a weakly, a very weakly coupled SU2, not just a zero coupling SU2.
So it looks like there shouldn't be such a symmetry because that one is gauged, but there still is if you go to weak coupling limit.
Exactly. And once we have the Zyberg-Witten curse written on the board, that'll be even more clear that this is the correct interpretation. Okay, so here's the second surprise, and the second as you would expect, if you apply that idea to either end of this linear quiver here, something very similar would happen, right? You could take the number 2 to be zero coupling, turning that into a flavor symmetry. Then you can permute the flavor symmetries any way you like. And wherever number 2 is, it's got a link at weak coupling, it's got a link back into the rest of the diagram. But the surprise happens if you try to do this with the SU2 number 2. So I want to make each of these weakly zero coupling. So I'm going to temporarily turn them into square boxes. So I've got my middle guy, number 2. I've got my square box, number 1. I've got my square box, number C. I've got my square box, number D. And my square box, number 3. And afterwards, I'm going to have my square box C, my square box D, my SU2 number 2, and then these guys, this is number 2, these guys 1 and 3 are going to, I'm going to re-gauge, if you like. So they have to then reattach to what they were attached to before. So 1 has to have, let's see, so it's decoupled from the C, but it still has to have its A and its B. Excuse me for not writing SU2 100 times. And this one is still attached to E and F. So this is a very pretty picture. It's a symmetric-looking picture in which my three SU2s each have a pair of fundamentals, and then somehow they're all linked together with a common representation. So that's the new and unusual thing. People hadn't thought about that before. And what this new representation is, effectively, is a bifundamental. So here was our standard picture for a bifundamental for two of the groups, in which the flavor symmetry, the flavor SU2 for that bifundamental representation has also been gauged. So altogether, I have two hypermultiples here. They're being acted on by three copies of SU2. The action is ineffective, I should say. If you look at it, I mean, there's some redundancy in how this gauge transformation acts according to these, but everything works out. I mean, if you look at how everything is coupled to, each SU2 is coupled to exactly four hypermultiplets, and so this still gives a conformal theory. It's just not one that's conventionally been described. Okay, so this is the kind of basic building block of some interesting kind of way of linking up three of these gauge groups at a time in some kind of fundamental structure. It's really bifundamental, in the SU2 case, bifundamental with gauged flavor symmetry. And that's going to be the tool for making interesting pictures.
So if you just want to describe the matter content of the gauge theory of SU2 cubed, with what matter?
It's SU2 cubed with a funny tri-fundamental field.
Is it 2, 2, 2, or not?
It's 2 comma 2 comma 2, except how does the flavor symmetry work, right? You've got this 2 vector and you've got multiplication. Excuse me, how did the bifundamental work? It was basically something like a 2 by 2 matrix with matrices multiply on the left and the right, and then the flavor symmetry is inserting AA inverse, or maybe conjugate transpose or something like that, right? Something of that sort. And so when I put in that third SU2, its action is already, it was already part of the gauged action. So I'm not actually gauging anything new, anything more. But that's... you look a little puzzled. I feel a little puzzled. Joe, are you puzzled?
I don't think so. I mean,
good.
It's the same move over and over again.
It's the same move over and over again. So if you buy the move, then you've got to buy the story.
This, this still has a Lagrangian description. It's just an explicit trifundamental field. Right?
It's...
you take all the gauge functions to be weak, and then you just have...
It's... I guess that's right. I mean, the reason I'm hesitant to answer yes is that when you do this for SU3, it starts to become
right.
weird.
I thought this was the 4-3 hypermultiplet.
This, well, so it's free hypermultiplet, right? So you could, there's another, the opposite thing to do to this is to send both of these couplings to zero, and then you have something interesting, which is a theory of just 4 free hypermultiplets that would have this SU2 cubed symmetry, except it's really only an SU2 squared, but somehow you put in the diagonal as the third one, being coupled to other things. The more I talk about it, the less convinced I get. I hope that's not true of you.
What are these representations?
So at the beginning of the story, we had some group, which is the gauge group of this theory, and we had some vector space, which is being acted on by G. And we're thinking of that vector space as coming in several parts. It's coming in a V1 and a V2 and so on. And we're identifying which of the representations of this group. So the group at the moment is SU2 cubed, and we're identifying which of the representations of SU2 cubed are occurring in this picture. So the input data for these N=2 supersymmetric gauge theories is pretty... elementary mathematically. We've just got a semisimple group and a particular representation of that group. Representation is chosen so that the theory is expected to be conformal, and that's something I can't explain quickly to somebody who doesn't already know what it is right at the moment, so I won't try.
So if you did this with SUN, there would be n-squared matter fields in any SUN.
Okay, so if I did SUN, then I could make the same kind of linear quiver for SUN. We need to think a little bit about what the flavor symmetry is for the bifundamental, but there are these bifundamentals. And then we also have to think about what flavor symmetry we associate to a pair of n's. Pair of fundamentals. I'm sorry, to an N. No, to N ends. To N ends, thank you. So what's the flavor symmetry of a bifundamental? Well, The reason I got a full SU2 flavor symmetry here, I have to say I don't completely understand the answer to this question. It's because it's a pseudo-real representation. So normally it would have been U1. So it's not exactly this, right? It's because it was a pseudo-real representation. I had some additional U1. Otherwise, I would have just had a U1 symmetry, which was essentially a diagonal on this side and undoing the diagonal on that side.
So if you did this with just SU4 manifest instead of SO8, you would have gotten something with U1 instead of SU2.
So, indeed, so if I take SUN with NF=2N, then I'm expecting to see just SU2n here when n is bigger than 2, not enhanced, right? And this SU2n, I'm actually going to split for this purpose as an SUn cross an SUn. Let me say that again. I actually get a U2n, not an SU2n, a U2n, and that's enhanced to UN cross UN. So the picture that Gayota draws here is that you really have, you still have two factors of your flavor symmetry. One of those factors is the SUN factor, and the other is the U1 that still exists. So here I'll have SUN and U1. Okay, well, I wanted to do this with just a single one first. So if I were doing it with a single one first, then you'll notice that of the three possible limits that I might take, there are two that are the same, that sort of show up as a U1 cross SUN on each side, describing flavor symmetry. But there's another funny limit, which is, in this diagrammatic language, has got a U1, a pair of U1s linked to this gauge SUN, and then whatever matter we have here is supposed to be equipped with an SUN cross SUN flavor symmetry. So this is the one that's tricky to describe. And I mentioned last time that the one of the changes between SU2 and SU capital N is that for SU2, we were working with the upper half plane. So I'm just looking now at SUN with MF equal to N. For SU2, we were looking at the upper half plane mod SL2Z. But for SUN N bigger than 2, we're actually looking at the upper half plane mod what's called gamma 0 of 2, an index 2 subgroup. There's an extra cusp, and that extra cusp corresponds to this diagrammatic possibility. In the case n equal 3, here's Gayota's claim. The claim is that at weak coupling, the SU3, sorry, at weak coupling with respect to the new cusp, the gauge symmetry is actually an SU2 subgroup of SU3. And it comes with a very long and complicated explanation of various aspects of this gauge symmetry. I wasn't going to do SU3 yet, but since you started me on it, I will try to do it. So the gauge symmetry is an SU2. This SU2 is also weakly couples this SU2 has with one hypermultiplet. So it has a conventional hypermultiplet, and it also weakly couples to an SU2 subgroup inside of the E6 global symmetry of the Minahan-Nimishansky E6 theory from 1996. The reason I know the year is that I gave a talk about this stuff at MIT last week, and Joe Manahan was there, and he said, "Oh, that's easy to date because we found that theory the year my son was born, and he's 13. So that mnemonic is not going to work for me forever, but it works for me this year. Because I'm not going to remember how old his son is. I guess I can always look up this paper and find out.
The naive interpretation of your diagram of the U1, U1, SUN, SUN,
yes.
SUN,
yes.
Would be that there are n squared flavors of the SUN gauge theory?
That's right.
But there's no weakly coupled limit where you see n squared flavors of the SUN
gauge. That's right. I think the claim is that you're going to see something. You're going to see something strange, and it's some interesting conformal object, which is hard to describe. And we can get our hands on it with n equals 3. For n equal 2, we were able to get our hands on it. For n equal 3, we're able to get our hands on it in some form. And then beyond that, it's a mystery.
I don't know if it's something you're looking for, but Galen and Molesine, I think, work out the anomaly coefficients for these various theories just by subtraction, which gives you kind of a count on the number of fields.
And do they grow like in...
They don't grow as fast.
I mean, they do not grow like in...
No, right.
I'm sorry?
So you can, any conformal field theory has these anomaly coefficients A and
C. Yeah, they don't grow like N cubed, which they shouldn't. They reproduce the large N behavior of the M5 brain, as they should, right? No, it's n to the 3 halves, isn't it?
No, that's n2 brain. The n5 brain is n3.
Let's see.
But it's confusing in a four-dimensional theory because with that much matter, it's very, very infrared free at large n.
So there's lots of fields. It's still not a very big...
Yeah, but there must be a strong gauge coupling. They're not really...
No, but they're... I don't remember the field content for the E6 theory. Do anybody remember? Okay. That would be one way to check whether it's N cubed. Anyway, he has various claims about this. For example, if you're just doing this single SU3 case, so he wants to make some kind of dictionary between the SU3 and what he calls SU2 in SU3. So that's going to be the one coupled to the E6 in some funny way. So this guy is going to have a single hypermultiplet, and really we should identify it by its gauge, by its flavor symmetry, the way we've been doing other ones. And it's also going to have this E6, right? So somehow the E6 is in there. So, for example, the E6 theory has a one-dimensional moduli space, and it's that one-dimensional moduli space is parameterized by the expectation value of some dimension 3 operator. And so that guy in this duality is supposed to correspond to trace phi cubed. On the other hand, the dimension 2 operators over here, the dimension 2 operators of the SU3, of course, correspond to dimension 2 operator of an SU2, no problem. But there was going to be this problem because there's no dimension 3 operator over there, so how did you get it? It's coming from the E6. He has all sorts of stuff. So I should also be able to recover, in the case of a single guy, somehow I've got to be able to recover U2N, U6 in there. And the way that the U6 global symmetry gets recovered in an appropriate weakly coupled limit is that the commutant of SU2 in E6 is SU6. And so that SU6, together with the U1 flavor symmetry of the hypermultiplet that's linked to the that's a representation of the SU2, adds up to the full SU6. And he has whole lists of sort of properties of the SU3 theory and this coupled theory, which are supposed to match up. None of those are new, actually. Those are or maybe not all of them are new. Many of them are the evidence that was presented by Argyris Seiberg and then later by Tachikawa and whoever in favor of this Argyris Seiberg duality. Thank you. So let's see. Last week I described the representation in terms of a punctured Riemann surface. And let me just mention what's going on with the punctured surface interpretation here. So for SUN and NF equal to N, I would have two punctures. But when N is equal, when N is bigger than 2, I have to sort of decorate those punctures in different ways. So this is something like the U1 puncture, and this is something like the SUN puncture. And the reason the decoration wasn't necessary in the N equal 2 case, capital N equal 2, is that this U1 got enhanced to an SU2 in that particular case. So the theory with punctures is going to have to be accompanied by some sort of taxonomy of punctures, various kinds, how they combine, what does it mean if you've got two punctures of one kind, of different kinds, or of the same kind, and perhaps there are even more kinds of punctures. Later in the paper, he makes for special unitary groups, he makes a dictionary between punctures and Young diagrams. So there's a whole collection of possible punctures that can go into these theories. Punctures don't collide at weak coupling in anything. So strong coupling, I think, is my answer. Okay, so let me try to describe the Seiberg-Witten curves for these guys. And the structure of the Seiberg-Witten curves is the fact that it matches with the basic picture that he's outlining is one of the big pieces of evidence that he has for the validity of his picture. So in this case of a linear quiver, so the linear quivers that we care about, we just had, I'll simplify it now. So we had a bunch of SUNs with bifundamentals, and then an N fundamentals at each end of the quiver. And that had this D4 NS5 brain representation, which I briefly described last time. And that representation lifts to M theory, as Witten explained also in 96. And when you do that lift to M theory, you can read off, so Witten proposed, a Seiberg-Witten curve based on the description of that lift to M theory. So I want to remind you or tell you what those are in these terms. So I'll start out just with the case N equal 2. So back to the SU2 theories. So in the SU2 theories, the claim is, so here I have N SU2s in my linear quiver, and two hypermultiples at the end. And the equation that Witten wrote down for the Seiberg-Witten curve in this case was something of degree, so it involves two variables, T and V, and it has degree 2 in V and degree little n plus 1 in T. And the curve is exactly this one, where the U1 up through UN parameterize the Coulomb branch of the theory. And at weak coupling, UI is supposed to be trace of phi I squared, goes like trace of phi I squared at weak coupling. And as usual in Seiberg-Witten theory, that those statements may change at stronger coupling. The C1 up through CN are equivalent data to gauge couplings, but the actual map to gauge couplings is a little bit more complicated. So this equation can be rewritten as V squared times the times some polynomial in T to the n plus 1 down to CN plus 1 plus or rather is equal to another polynomial in T, which looks like U1 T to the N down to UN T. So if I take the left-hand side of that expression, I can sort of formally factor it into roots t minus ta, so those are the roots of this guy, and the tau parameter, the complexified coupling for the eighth factor of the gauge group is 1 over pi I times the log of the, oh, and I should say this is invariant up to scaling, well, I guess it doesn't matter for this formula. Should have said here, without loss of generality, I can set T0 equal 1 or something like that if I choose. The equation was really not, I can scale the equation without affecting anything in any way. So I just take the ratio of adjacent roots in that way, take the 1 over pi I times the log, and I get the gauge couplings. So these coefficients, through this slightly complicated formula, determine the gauge couplings. So this is all without mass deformations. And the Zeiber-Witten differential, again, Witten formula, is just lambda equals V dt over t. So with that normalization of T0 equal 1, in the case of little n equal 1, a single copy, that just becomes t minus 1, v squared times t minus 1, t minus t sub 1, is equal to u times t. That's the only thing we have. And, of course, the Zeiber-Witten differential in this case just looks like root u divided by the square root of t times t minus 1 times t minus t sub 1 dt. So it's the standard thing where the tau parameter corresponds to the elliptic curve, y squared equals t times t minus 1 times t minus t sub 1. And now this s-duality shuffling, which rearranges the set of four punctures, is just the permutations on the branch points here. So the permutations on branch points corresponds to the s-duality that we were talking about before. And as we know, that doesn't affect the actual value of tau. It only affects the uniformizing parameter. It doesn't affect the J of tau, the SL2Z invariant part. It only affects the uniformizing parameter tau. So Gaeta wants to rewrite this in some nifty way by using a linear fractional transformation. Gosh. I have no clue. I miscopied something. I guess that's a Z. I don't really know. The equation can be modified into an equation which just looks like x squared equals u over some polynomial of degree 4 in z, and the t1 is just the cross ratio of the roots. And in this version, lambda is x dz. More generally, if you take this general form that Witten wrote down and you do this, a slight coordinate change, then the polynomial can be rewritten in the form x squared is some what looks like a function of z, and the invariant description of this function is that phi 2 of z times dz squared is a quadratic differential so z is a coordinate on the punctured Riemann surface, which we've been using to kind of describe these diagrams. So this is a quadratic differential on this punctured Riemann surface maybe sigma, and xdz is the Zeiberg-Witten differential. And I should say that phi 2 has poles at the punctures. So a simple algebraic rewriting of Witten's version of the formula with a little change of coordinates gives this expression. And in fact, the invariant way that Gayato describes this expression is to think of z, as I mentioned, as a coordinate on sigma, and x as an additional coordinate on the cotangent bundle of sigma, so that x and z are somehow naturally associated to this punctured curve that's giving the data. The locations of the punctures, well, the locations of the punctures, which is where the poles go, those are showing up as the zeros of, as the t sub a's, right? The zeros there, which tell us where the couplings go. And the moduli of this whole thing is the set of n punctured spheres. Otherwise known as M, it's, sorry, I'm not counting the number of punctures correctly. So I get, so the punctures are somehow associated to the flavor groups, not the gauge groups. And so I had N minus 1 in between my N symmetry groups plus 4, so it's N plus 3 punctured spheres. And that's called M0N. So by paying attention to the kind of invariance in the way Witten wrote the curve down and making a change of coordinates to exploit that, you could write everything always as a double cover of some punctured Riemann surface with poles at the punctures in the double cover business. Of course, there are also zeros which affect the description here, the quadratic differential. The Zeiberg-Witten curve contains the information about the Coulomb branch. The original set of punctures didn't contain information about the Coulomb branch. It was containing information about the couplings. Right. So I neglected to point out, for example, that here, having made this identification, I can assign tau goes to I infinity with the standard weakly coupled description, right? That's what this identification of the coupling means. And then the manipulations I did with moving the four flavor groups around exactly correspond to taking other standard limits as tau goes to zero or other places, zero or one, anyway, the other standard limits which correspond to those permutations, which we know are equivalent under SL2Z, which is why this is an S duality transformation. Here that's being generalized, where the gauge couplings are being read off of these values of T sub A, and there are essentially N plus 3 independent, excuse me, N plus 3 punctures that one has to make. I keep saying N plus 3, but I'm only seeing N plus 2. I'm seeing N. Oh, no, sorry, this has N plus 1 roots. So there's the N plus 1 roots of these guys together with 0 and infinity. Those are the places in those coordinates where things get punctured. This is a more natural presentation where you haven't fixed the location of two of the punctures, but you've let them all vary and corresponds to the moduli in a better way.
For larger N, what is the Zeiberg-Witten curve?
So for larger N, the Zeiberg-Witten curve involves an nth power instead of a second power, and it involves more data because you need coefficient. So, for example, for SU3, it's x cubed is equal to a quadratic differential times x.
And I meant the number of SU2s.
Little n, you meant the number of SU2s. Zeiberg-Witten differential is always this. Zeiberg-Witten differential or curve?
Curve.
The curve is this. Here it is, little n. This was Ed's description of the curve.
What's the genus
of this curve? This It's appropriate. I have to work out how big the Coulomb branch is.
It's n-dimensional, right?
The Coulomb branch is n-dimensional. I also have the locations of the punctures. But there's a shift symmetry in V. Oh, no, I can't shift V because of the square. So it must just be 2n plus 3?
Yeah, I'm just confused about, is there a relation between that weird curve and this m0n?
The m0n is measuring where the gauge couplings are. I mean, that's the space of gauge couplings.
Oh, okay.
The Seiberg-Witten curve depends on the gauge couplings and the Coulomb branch parameters. That's correct. Shall we do the mass deformation? So the mass deformation, well, I've already written it in this sort of nice form without the mass deformation. So I had the product from 0 to n of t minus t sub a multiplying v squared. And the mass deformation, I put in a v term with a sort of mass polynomial, a polynomial of degree n plus 1 in t. And then I put in the u polynomial, but now it's an arbitrary polynomial of degree n plus 1 in t. So that involves potentially a two new terms. So the t to the n plus 1 and the t sub 0 terms are new in the mass deformation. So I'm actually putting in n plus 3 mass parameters. Well, it looks like n plus 4 because I've got these two new ones plus the n plus 2 coefficients there, but there's a shift in V that I can now do. I couldn't do a shift in V before, but I can now do it. So they're really n plus 3 parameters that matches the number of factors in my global symmetry group. The Seiberg-Witten curve has poles. The Seiberg-Witten differential has poles. In this case, and as is typical, one can sort of say what the residues of those poles are in terms of the mass parameters. But what I want to write down for you is Gyota's sort of reformulation of this in better coordinates. So the reformulation involves completing the square on V. In order to do that, I have to multiply by another copy of this polynomial. So if I complete the square on V, I'll end up with an expression like this, minus a quarter times the square of the mass polynomial. And the Seiberg-Witten differential can be shifted without essential change. So what does it mean? I'm adding something exact to this differential, and therefore I'm not really changing the periods in any effective way. I do maybe have to change the basis that I was using to compute periods. It can be so making that change of variables changes the Seiberg-Witten differential, but now you can shift it by adding something exact back to being V, this time it's V dt over t. So, and with that normalization for the Seiberg-Witten differential, at each puncture, the two inverse images have poles with opposite residue. So it's a very sort of pleasing way of looking at it. And you can read mass terms off of coefficients of double poles in this picture. So with this normalization, the double poles exactly determine where the coefficients of the double poles exactly determine the mass parameters of the theory. So this all hangs together very nicely, and now Gyota proposes to extend it to cases where the quiver wasn't just a linear quiver or even a tree, but the quiver is allowed to be have arbitrary topology. In particular, it's allowed to have loops. So I'll have a quiver with G loops. And I'll have G loops and N punctures. And one of the arguments for being able to construct these theories is that we can now assemble them out of basic data. So the basic data in the graph consists of being able to put together these funny trivalent vertices and link together various gauge groups, which are sort of in the center, in the midpoints of segments, by trivalent vertices, and eventually end up with certain punctures playing a role in these guys. But we will also allow loops. And make graphs of that kind, and just assemble these mysterious-looking trivalent vertices things together with gauge groups to form these objects. Now, the formalism for writing a Seiberg-Witten curve for those is exactly the same as has been as is already on the board. Namely, I'll just take an appropriate quadratic differential. I'll take the double cover there. The quadratic differential is supposed to have poles at the punctures. If I want the mass deformation, then I do a similar thing where my Seiberg-Witten differential now has certain poles, and where I'm assuming that the residues at the two inverse images of a pole are equal and opposite, that there are poles at the inverse images of a puncture, excuse me, with equal and opposite residue. So this is a full story for n equal 2 theories where you have lots of n equal 2s, maybe linked up into loops. All of the discussion about s-dualities and various limits can now be phrased in terms of finding places where the corresponding punctured Riemann surface develops thin necks corresponding to those deformations. Gosh. Well, it was much ado about n equal 2, right? So we'll have several lectures. So a picture such as the one I had a minute ago with, say, three groups like this, and remember that we've enhanced this so that there are additional punctures separating these guys, and the endpoints are also supposed to have associated punctures. What does that look like in terms of a Riemann surface? Well, here are my two punctures, and then here is the connection, and the length of that connection, the size of that connection, is effectively giving me the gauge coupling. And then in this little region, I'll put a puncture. So here, I can think of this as a kind of trivalent vertex piece with two punctures and a connection. Here I've got two connections and a puncture. Again, I've got two connections and a puncture. And then finally at the end, two connections. So it's the lengths of these curves which are governing the gauge couplings of the three groups. And weakly coupled simultaneously in all of these would have meant doing this degeneration of the punctured Riemann surface. That's a standard limit point in this moduli space of, in this case, six punctured Riemann surfaces. But there are other ones, such as the one that I did that revealed the nature of the trivalent vertex, where you brought two up here. Gosh, how do I do it? Two here looks like an alien. A three-headed alien. There we go. And then here's a pair of pants that links them together. So here are the three weakly coupled guys. And that's another limit point in this moduli space. So the identification of various weakly coupled limits, various s-duality frames, if you like, with limit points where these various necks degenerate, that can also be sort of read off of the behavior of the Zweig-Witten curve in such limits. So it's not completely obvious what happens in such limits, but in such limits, near the point that's near the neck that's pinching off on the punctured Riemann surface, you end up acquiring a new double pole on the quadratic differential, and you can write what's left as essentially a quadratic differential on one side and a quadratic differential on the other side. Well, and the fact that you got this double pole there as you're approaching it makes it look like a mass term associated with another flavor group. It's consistent with that the identification of the mass terms that we also had. So it all hangs together in an extremely nice way, including the explicit equations that Witten had found by the lift to M theory for the Zweig-Witten curves. So I wrote down and erased, at Shama's request, the SU3 Zweig-Witten curve as well. Yeah, actually, maybe I should pause and ask if there are questions. I'm actually not sure what we would gain by writing down the, you know, it's a cubic equation, and because there are different kinds of branching behavior near the punctures that are possible, you can label the punctures with different kinds of things. And once you've got that Zweig-Witten curve written down and identified that there had to be different behavior at those two punctures, the pair of which was associated to the hypermultiplets at the end of the chain, and then you do this, you can ask what happened, what is the meaning of one of these pairs of pants where the two where the punctures were the same instead of different. And that's the place where, you know, so a little bit of information about the meaning can be extracted from the Zweig-Witten curve, but then anyway, Gaiotto has lots of sort of side runs at the problem, but no direct argument for why that funny SU2 coupled to E6 is the correct answer. But that's the content of the Argyris-Zweig duality. Maybe this is a good place to stop for today. So I'll just announce again that next week we've got Francesco Benigni coming, and he'll be talking about the n equal 1 deformations of these n equal 2 theories. And then I will resume more n equal 2 stuff. I would like feedback from people about whether you want to see more detailed Zweig-Witten stuff, or shall I branch off into the Gaiotto-Moronitsky interpretation of it. There are various directions we could go at this point. And I'm also happy to have volunteers to give other talks. So. Questions? Yes? No? You're volunteering?
Yep.
No. You're not volunteering, I understand.
I have a question.
Yes?
And you can also tell me later, but it's just kind of on the quiver representation theory side of this. So when you have like the U1s for the flavor, is that the same as saying there's a C-star action that doesn't act faithful in the representation space? So it's like a GL instead, or sorry, PGL instead of a GL. Action for isomorphism.
No.
Okay.
I think that's the quick answer to that is no. Maybe there is a longer answer I can try to give you.
And having these trifundamental patterns, has there been any like thought about formulating that as like an algebra, like a similar to a Clipper algebra?
Let me indirectly answer the question by pointing out that when you're doing n equal 1 theories and you're describing them as quiver theories, then one of the ingredients in the field theory is a superpotential. And the structure of that superpotential is what gives us a lot of algebraic tools to study those theories. In n equal 2, we don't have a superpotential. Or rather, the superpotential has its form completely constrained by the n equal 2 supersymmetry. So we don't add that as an extra ingredient, and therefore the rich algebraic structure, which you're very familiar with for n equal 1, doesn't have a counterpart in this case. Yes?
If you think of the Seibert-Witten curves for SU2 as like a pencil of cubics, and then you get this interpretation as a rational elliptic surface, is there an interpretation here, like a global interpretation of the family of Seibert-Witten curves?
So it's going to depend. For SU2, it's going to be hyperelliptic. So yeah. Somehow I'll have some family of hyperelliptic curves over MGN. Mm-hmm. Okay. I don't know what the properties of that family are.
What I meant then, like looking at the residues, you got the very nice structure coming from the rational elliptic surface.
Right.
And the question would be whether there's some similar description.
That's an excellent question for somebody to investigate, Andreas. Any more? Okay, that'll do it for today.